This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's great to have you with us today. And we're going to talk about an important subject for many people across the state of North Dakota and everywhere in the world, for that matter, heart disease and stroke and early intervention. Last Friday's Prairie Pulse television show focused on heart disease and stroke and the importance of prompt treatment to get the best outcome. We'll hear about it today from the perspective of a heart patient, Prairie Public CEO and President John Harris, and two experts, Sanford physicians Dr. Michael Manchek and Dr. Thomas Haldis. Here's their conversation.
Thanks for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
Dr. Haldis, talk about the advances in heart procedures over the years, 12 years here at Sanford. But, you know, we always talk about advances that we have. You know, what have you seen? And then how are some of these performed and the effectiveness of the procedures that you do?
Well, in the era of dealing with ischemic heart disease, we're talking about blockages in the heart arteries themselves. So the heart itself is a muscle. It's fed by blood vessels that are on the surface. They can become blocked, and then the muscle of that heart can then become, you know, with lack of blood flow, can die, you know, as a result of heart attack, or you can wind up having chest pain as a result of those blockages with exertion. So the drug-eluting stent over the past several years has had several iterations. So that's probably one of the bigger advances in terms of dealing with ischemic heart disease. On the structural end of the spectrum, dealing with valves, that has been massive, and it has been a total game changer when it comes to dealing with people with aortic stenosis, which is a blockage of the aortic valve, and also mitral regurgitation, which is leakage of the mitral valve. Absolute game changer. So what has happened now is we have people who ordinarily were not candidates for treatment. They were either too old or too high risk for surgery. Now they are perfect candidates for this minimally invasive procedure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Manchek, so what are some of the signs of strokes, and how are they now better treated than in previous years?
So basically we tell people anything that comes on suddenly, and sudden onset weakness on one side of the body, sudden onset of numbness on one side of the body, trouble speaking or understanding people, trouble seeing out of one or both eyes, sudden onset of feeling like you're off balance or clumsy, slurred speech, anything like that comes under the worrisome signs of a stroke. And these days, in fact, you know, really the last 3 to 5 years, there's been a huge leap forward in terms of what we're able to offer stroke patients with a specific procedure that involves threading a catheter all the way up through one of the arteries in the leg or in the arm into the skull and physically removing the clot. This is something that we weren't able to offer patients even, like I said, just a few years back, because either we didn't have the people who were trained in it, or we didn't have the advances in the actual devices that are used to do it. But multiple trials have come out demonstrating that it's both safe and extremely effective in some cases to have folks who are trained as neurosurgeons or as neurologists who can do this procedure, or even in Dr. Haldis's case, an interventional cardiologist capable of doing this procedure, where the clot that's blocking the artery and that's starving the brain of blood and oxygen is just taken out. And in many instances, people have immediate recovery right in the room when the procedure's done. So they go from not being able to move one side of their body or speak or see to being nearly back to normal.
Can both of you talk, and maybe is it different or not, about how time is of the essence with either, of course, a heart attack or a stroke? But Dr. Manchek, we'll just go ahead and stay with you.
Well, we always quote this number to people, 2 million. It's 2 million brain cells dying every single minute in the midst of a stroke. So if patients don't recognize those signs and symptoms of a stroke that I discussed, and they don't get themselves to a hospital by calling 911, as fast as possible, a significant amount of brain tissue can be lost, and no matter what we do, it's not going to be able to take that to save that brain. So it is a very time-sensitive emergency.
So for a stroke, you're losing brain cells every minute. What about a heart issue, a heart attack?
A heart issue has similar problems. If you were to, say, take a coronary artery and just clamp it, and there's no other collateral supply, you've got 3 hours before it's completely dead. So you have 3 hours to do something about this blocked vessel. If, you know, in some cases you have some collateral flow or there's some preconditioning because there had been a tight blockage, sometimes you can buy yourself a little bit more time. But in general, we say, you know, 3 hours is the limit that you have. When it comes to these, you know, stroke, heart attack, and others, as time-sensitive emergencies, one of the biggest issues that we have is patient recognition. And I think this is something that you and I had talked about before. We've done very well in the state STEMI program. So that's the heart attack stroke program, or heart attack program and the stroke program around the state, and making sure that people who present to medical facilities are recognized, transported to wherever the stroke procedure or the heart attack procedure is done. And then when they get to us, the procedure is done quickly. So if you arrive at Sanford Medical Center, for example, and you have a heart attack, basically it's going to take less than an hour to have that blood vessel completely opened. You know, there's 10 minutes to do an EKG. There's strict guidelines within our facility. From that point on, they'll activate the cath team. If it's during day hours and everybody is there, you could be up in the cath lab within 10 minutes, and personally, we'll have that artery open within 15 minutes of you arriving in the cardiac catheterization lab. So that's the key point. Where we are falling down in North Dakota is with regard to patient recognition of the symptoms. And this is the most important thing. So if I can get the patient from first medical contact to the device to open up the blood vessel, and I can get that done in an hour, guess how much time it takes from the patient's symptom onset to get to the medical contact? And that's about 3.5 hours. Mm-hmm. It's way too long. So we talked about 3 hours being an important number. Most people are waiting beyond that time. And then we're just in a salvage mode when it comes to opening up the blood vessel. So the key thing is, and the key take-home point from this meeting, I hope, is that people will learn that I need to take chest pain seriously, any sort of chest pain, whether it's, you know, chest up into the shoulder, into the neck, something typical, something atypical. Get it checked out. If you need to run to your primary care provider because you're afraid to go to the ER, then do it. But in general, our recommendation is to call 911 immediately, because in North Dakota, first medical contact equals EMS. The EMS rigs are all equipped with an EKG. They can all diagnose the bad type of heart attack that we treat emergently in the rig, in your house, in the field, in the farm, wherever you are, they can diagnose it. And then we can activate our helicopter to come and pick you up wherever you are. So that'll really trim the time down.
Today, Main Street is sharing an excerpt from last week's Prairie Pulse television show about heart disease and stroke, and we're going to hear about it from the perspective of a heart patient. That's our very own John Harris after this.
Support for this program is provided by Great River Energy and its 320 employees who are partnering with North Dakota to help our country meet its growing demands for energy while utilizing new technologies for a cleaner environment.
Hi, I'm Christopher O'Reilly, host of From the Top from NPR. It all goes back to being 4 years old and going to St. Athanasius Catholic School in Evanston, Illinois. They said that you could have French lessons or piano lessons at $15 a week. Take your pick. And that's basically how I got to where I am today. I would have been terrified to tell my piano teacher when I was a kid that I was learning, you know, the organ solo to The Doors Light My Fire. From the Top has been engaging in the YouTube platform, mixing genres, lots of interaction with, you know, great people from classical and crossover world, kids collaborating with Time for Three, Joshua Bell. There was a really great one with Pink Martini. I really enjoyed that. I did one with kids on From the Top, and it was about the time of the Muslim ban and Lady Gaga's performance of Woody Guthrie at the Super Bowl. So I had 6 immigrant alums of From the Top, and we collected all of their various national anthems and made snippets of it into a piece that introduced This Land Is Your Land. And we did that at the YouTube studios itself. Join me every Sunday at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain, From the Top on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Last Friday's Prairie Pulse television show focused on heart disease and stroke and the importance of early intervention. And John Harris had a discussion with Sanford doctors Michael Manchek and Thomas Haldis about something very close to him.
Well, Dr. Haldis, one of the reasons we're probably here today is obviously I had an event on December the 11th, 2017, where I walked right out of this studio with just a little sweat at my hairline. And I just thought I was getting a fever. By the time I went two blocks in my truck, I thought I was going to be violently ill. Still thought I was just sick, a flu bug, a stomach bug. And by the time I went another half a mile, my neck and shoulders did start hurting. Of course, I ended up driving on home, don't live far from work, and had my wife drive me to the hospital. And you were the one that actually took care of me. And so can you talk about that procedure and maybe what I did wrong even and what I could have done better?
Okay, well, you know, first of all, yeah, I mean, had you ever had nausea like that before?
No.
Had you ever had a cold that came on all of a sudden and made you nauseated and felt like you were going to, you know, just, you know, whatever in the car?
No.
You didn't. So, I mean, these are new symptoms for you. So people, what they need to do is they need to recognize something that is really out of the ordinary, okay? They also need to recognize that there are lots of masqueraders, or essentially chest pain and heart pain can masquerade as other things. I mean, how many times have I heard somebody say, oh, you know, I had something bad to eat, I thought it was indigestion. Well, you know, if you have really bad indigestion and it doesn't go away within, you know, say an hour, you know, why not get it checked out? You know, because it could be something significant. You know, I'd expect that if I took a Tums or something after indigestion that I'd start feeling better. If I'm still feeling lousy and I'm starting to feel all this, you know, stuff like you experienced, nausea, sweating, maybe even some chest discomfort, you got to go in. You got to get checked out. So in general, the rule is call 911. And the reason being is that we can diagnose it quicker. Okay? There's been a few people that have presented from a private vehicle. They mean well. They're driving on in. And then the husband has a cardiac arrest in the passenger seat. Okay? It's nearly impossible to do CPR and drive at the same time. They say don't text and drive. Definitely don't do CPR and drive. Okay? So just the best thing to do, honestly, is just to call 911 and get checked out in that respect, because they can diagnose it at your house.
Yeah. Well, for me, hindsight, obviously it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up with, you opened up a blood vessel, artery for me,
mm-hmm.
and put two stents in, and like I say, no heart damage, no other blockages. So I turned out okay, but I could have done some things different. And I did think about 911, but I just didn't know what to do.
That's a common issue. And at the regional state STEMI conference, we were discussing just this problem, and this is going to be our next focus as the next year moves on, and that is how to increase public awareness. We've done all sorts of education. You know, it's basically, it hasn't really influenced our times from symptom onset to that first medical contact. And we talked about some of the barriers, you know, because some of the people on the board, you know, they've had heart issues. So what exactly is it? And, you know, I think a lot of those people say, hey, listen, you know, it's an expensive bill to call EMS. You know, gosh, I'm in denial. I don't want to admit that I've got a heart problem. I can tell you personally, if I have chest pain, I'm probably going to be the last one to call 911, right? But we have to understand that there's other places that you can go. You can go to your primary care physician. You can go to the urgent care center. You can, you know, we have, Sanford has walk-in clinics that will see people and diagnose these problems. So if you're afraid of that, you know, of that bill, I honestly don't want people to avoid coming for medical therapy or for evaluation because they're afraid of an ambulance bill. If that truly is the case, then you know what? Fine, drive yourself if you have to. But at least get some sort of an evaluation, because it's only an EKG that you need. You only need that EKG. Once that EKG is done and you've been evaluated, then we've eliminated essentially the big one, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's some other things that we can do in the interim to sort of make sure that you're not having the medium one or the little one.
And while I didn't know what was going on, and my symptoms started about 5:15 in the afternoon as I was leaving work and going home, I guess the one thing I did right was I told my wife, get me to some help.
Yep.
And we did get there. And I literally, in my episode, it was from 5:15 until 7:30. I had two stents, laying in a hospital bed, watching television thanks to the procedure that you did for me.
Yeah.
So it's important to get there quick. What about the success rates in the area, and what do you consider success? Because obviously if you wait too long, there is potential heart damage.
Well, you know, with regard to the heart, you know, the success rates in terms of doing the procedure, you know, are you know, we'll get it open. You know, it's as close to 100% as you can imagine. But, you know, what is the actual effect on the heart? So, I mean, if we've lost all the heart muscle and we open up the blood vessel, I mean, dead meat doesn't beat, right? So you're still stuck with, you know, dead muscle in the heart if you wait too long. So that, in my mind, even though we got a good angiographic result where the blood vessels open, you know, if the muscle isn't functioning properly, then that's not necessarily a successful outcome for our statewide STEMI program. So the real key to success is getting in quick, getting in and having some sort of reperfusion, meaning that the blood vessel has been open soon enough to save the muscle. So if we get the muscle open, you know, under an hour, you know, you may not even have any sort of release of biomarkers, which are the special proteins that wind up getting released when heart muscle dies. You might not even be able to detect it if you get it done early enough.
Okay. Well, Dr. Manchek, what about you? What do you consider, what success rate do you have? And yeah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we actually, you know, a few things that I'm proud of about our program, our stroke program at Sanford Fargo. One is that nationally, only about 5% of patients are treated with a medication called TPA. That's a medication that we give in the vein. It's the clot-busting medication meant to open up a blocked artery from a clot that's blocking it and starving the brain of blood flow. 5% nationally, we treat 20% of patients with that medication. One of the benchmarks that has been set forth by American Heart, American Stroke Association for the time to treat patients with TPA is they want at least 50% of patients to be treated within 60 minutes of arrival at your facility. At Sanford Fargo, that number is 78%. You know, in another measure, they want 75% less than 60 and 50% less than 45. And we actually have 63% less than 45 minutes. So we're really good at getting that medication, that clot-busting medication, into people if they get there in time. So that's one thing that I'm very proud of. Another thing that I'm very proud of is that the time to do the procedure that I mentioned earlier, where a catheter is threaded up into the brain and the clot is removed, physically removed. National benchmarks want people to go from the door of the emergency room to the table to have that procedure within 90 minutes, and then from the time that the artery is accessed to the time that the artery in the brain is open in an additional 60 minutes. So you're looking at 150 minutes. That's the national benchmark that's recently come out, and we do it on average at Sanford Fargo in about 40 to 45 minutes. So we have incredibly fast times, if not the fastest in the country, for getting those blood vessels open with that procedure once the patient hits our door. But I don't consider anything a success unless the patient hits our door as quickly as possible. So just to echo what Dr. Halda said, it's about symptom recognition. It's about activating EMS. I understand that people, particularly in our region, are inclined to drive themselves because the mentality is it will take too long to call the ambulance and have them drive out and then take me to the hospital. I can get there faster by myself. And what I say to those folks is, look, you don't know what's going to happen in route. You don't know how worse you're going to get or how worse your loved one is going to get in route in your car. Plus, you don't have the advantage of having medicines on board in the ambulance to treat certain complications from a stroke. You don't have any ability to let the hospital know ahead of time that you're coming so that the stroke team there is mobilized and ready to act quickly. So the best thing that they can do is see the signs, call 911, get to the hospital with an ambulance, and then you know, hopefully, you know, all things go well and the patient gets there. They receive either that clot buster or that procedure or both, and they end up having little to no deficits neurologically, and they function well and they function independently when they go home.
Okay. Well, once a heart procedure is done, what typically are lifestyle changes that people have to make, and how do you direct that with patients?
I go over all the risk factors. You know, if your blood pressure is high, you lower it. If you're diabetic, get it treated. If you have high cholesterol, lower it. You can't do anything about your family history, right? Mm-hmm. If you smoke, you really got to stop. That's the one thing I always say. I say, hey, can you help me out? Can you stop the smoking? Because that is a major risk factor. And these things are additive in a fact that it almost magnifies what your pre-risk is. Suppose you have a family history of heart disease, right? And suppose you have the little gene that gets tickled when you smoke, and now all of a sudden there's a massive fire in your coronary arteries that leads to some blockages. So all those things play a part. Just being healthy and leading a healthy lifestyle is important. There's a thing called the metabolic syndrome that's very important. And I mean, there's so much of it out there. You know, it's abdominal obesity, it's high triglyceride levels, and it's hyperglycemia, meaning that your blood sugar is too high. So that trifecta leads to significant issues with progression of blockages in the heart arteries, probably related to stroke as well. And those are the things that we try to reverse. And there's other things that go along with it as well. So, you know, there's such an interplay. So if you have that metabolic syndrome, you know, you're probably also going to wind up having obstructive sleep apnea. And then if you have obstructive sleep apnea, you wind up having worse hypertension. So it's just a vicious feedback loop. So these are the things that I generally talk to the patients about and try and get them on board and help out with their own care.
Dr. Manchek, kind of go the same way. Sometimes people think a stroke, you end up with more issues than a longer road.
Right.
And so how do you treat that with your patients and talk to them about that and success stories you've had?
Right. So, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that stroke does not discriminate. It affects all ages, all races, men and women. It doesn't matter. It doesn't discriminate. A lot of the risk factors that Dr. Haldis alluded to, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, smoking, diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, those are all risk factors that are theoretically controllable in a patient population. There are some patients who don't have any of those, that are young and healthy, and maybe they have something about their blood that makes it prone to clotting. I mean, there's a lot of different things that go into why you had a stroke. And what I try to do with each patient is approach it from the standpoint of, okay, what caused your stroke? Okay, was it a heart problem? Was it a heart rhythm problem? Was it a problem because you have diseased blood vessels? What caused your stroke? And what can we do to manage everything possible to keep you from having a second one? Because in 2016, there were about 800,000 strokes in the United States, and about 200,000 of them were recurrent strokes. So we're not doing as well as we could do to keep people from having a stroke the first time, and certainly not even the second time. So we need to tailor. That's what I try to do. I try and tailor each sort of game plan to the particular patient and what they have as far as risk factors and what we need to do to keep them from ever having to show up to a hospital again with a stroke.
Yeah. Well, we've got about a minute left, guys. Time's going by quick. What's the biggest challenge with your job?
Well, the biggest challenge right now is trying to get people to recognize their symptoms early. I think if we can trim that 3 hours down, you're going to see a drastic drop in mortality in North Dakota from heart attacks. I think that's a big challenge right now, and I really appreciate you you bringing this to the airwaves so we can try and educate the people in our neighborhoods, because you know we're all here to help out people in North Dakota. I mean that's what this is all about, and that's why I live here. So let's see if we can make a difference here and get treated sooner.
And Dr. Manchek, biggest challenge?
The exact same one.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Prairie Pulse host John Harris talking with Drs. Michael Manchek and Thomas Haldis about heart disease and stroke. You can watch any Prairie Pulse show, including this one, of course, on Prairie Public's YouTube channel. Coming up on Main Street, another interview from last week's UND Writers Conference. Bill Thomas talks with a poet who's written a dark story about eugenics at a state hospital. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Jamestown High School administrator suffered a case of nicotine poisoning after confiscating an e-cigarette from a student. Nancy Neary is the tobacco control director for the Central Valley Health District in Jamestown. She says Jamestown High Assistant Vice President, Principal John Conway confiscated an e-cigarette and accompanying liquid from a student in one of the school's restrooms.
When he handled that, some of the oils on the outside of the bottle got on his hand.
Neary says Conway got sick almost immediately.
He was nauseous. He was disoriented. He got very emotional. It was pretty frightening experience for him.
Neary says it doesn't take much of the liquid nicotine to cause health problems. She says young children could also be very susceptible to this.
Many of them are candy flavored. Most of them are. And they'll have packaging that looks like if it's gummy bear flavored, that's a popular flavoring. And there are gummy bears on the actual bottle. And then it also smells sweet. And so if they ingest any amount of the liquid really, or even as little as like a tablespoon, it can kill them.
Neary and the state health department want to dispel rumors that e-cigarettes and the liquids are nicotine-free. Grand Forks is asking the state of North Dakota for another $9.8 million to help complete the new water treatment plant. City Administrator Todd Phelan says the amount is based on a revised cost estimate, $149.8 million. That's down from the $152 million figure released in the fall of 2016. The city has submitted the numbers to the North Dakota Water Commission for review and possible inclusion in Governor Doug Burgum's budget recommendation to the 2019 legislature.
A majority of the money on the project will likely be spent this year. So this is going to be a large investment year for the water treatment plant. I think by the end of this year, we'll have a better picture of where things are because a significant sum of money will be invested this year.
Phelan says the goal has always been a 50-50 cost share with the state.
The city did ask for a 50-50 cost share just because it's a large project, it's a regional project, whereas in other water supply projects like the water plant, they're eligible up to 60 to 75%, but we thought a 50-50 cost share was fair and reasonable with the size and scope of our project.
The city has received $30 million in each of the last two legislative sessions for plant construction. The project is on schedule for a June 2020 completion date. And an annual event at NDSU is aimed at giving 8th grade girls a glimpse into what it would be like to pursue a career in engineering. About 300 8th grade girls from 10 schools in the Fargo-Moorhead and surrounding areas attended the Introduce a Girl to Engineering Day event at NDSU. Nancy Rosland is director of advancement for the College of Engineering at NDSU. She says it's important to introduce girls to the STEM or science, technology, and engineering and math careers early. She says a panel discussion with current women engineers and student engineers also helps the girls believe they can enter the field.
We want them to be able to see themselves, you know, in the future on that same, similar type career path.
The girls had the opportunity to ask questions of the panel after a morning activity where they got to work on problem-solving skills. Rosland says they were given a set of materials and asked to design a heart valve that allows blood flow through the heart.
I've heard some that say, I've said, this is so hard, but it's really fun. Or I've heard, some say, that it's certainly challenging, but when they were done with the activity, for example, and they had success with it, that there was a certain level of satisfaction, associated with that. I think one of the comments I heard from one of our industry people is the amount of creativity in that room, where they were all given the same problem and a set of materials, yet their solution to the problem was very different from group to group. And so I think that's something we celebrate in engineering, is that there's not always one way to solve a problem.
Rosland says women have a unique role to fill in engineering career. She says they bring a different dynamic to the field as well as many different approaches to problem solving. She says the earlier they can be shown that women have a path to engineering, the more likely they are to enter the field. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bakken Oil Business Journal, a print and digital journal dedicated to connecting business and resources in the oil and gas industry, Bakken and beyond. Learn more at BakkenOilBiz.com or on Facebook. The University of Mary presents the 2018 Vocations Jamboree in Bismarck, April 17th through the 19th. Speaker Dr. Gianna Emanuela Mola, whose mother was canonized as a saint in 2004, will share her mother's memory, example, testimony, and spirituality in her keynote address Wednesday, April 18th, 7:30 p.m. in the new Founders Hall inside the Lumen Vitae University Center. This event is free and open to the public. Registration available online at umary.edu/vocjam or by phone at 701-355-8102.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The UND Writers Conference took place last week, and this year the annual event featured authors and discussions around the theme Truth and Lies. One of the invited authors was poet Molly McCulley Brown, whose book, The Virginia State Home for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, dealt with the highly controversial practice of eugenics that took place at state hospitals across the U.S. in the early 20th century. This is the idea that you could improve the human race by removing pieces of it who were considered to be less able, perhaps feeble-minded was the term they used at that time.
Too.
Yeah. Well, that's the voice of our director of radio, Bill Thomas, who attended the conference and talked with Brown.
Yes, and Molly McCulley Brown was a great conversationalist, as you'll hear in a moment. One thing that doesn't come through on the radio, she's in a wheelchair. She has cerebral palsy as a result of damage at birth. It obviously didn't affect her thinking and her writing, but it makes it especially personal for her because back in the day, she might have ended up at the Virginia State Home or a place like that. And so I asked her about this theme, Truth and Lies, which seemed to really resonate with a lot of people and drew a lot of people into the Writers' Conference, and how she felt among these writers of prose and highly researched nonfiction books as a poet there. And that's what she addresses.
You know, it's been a real pleasure. I think, you know, we had a really great conversation yesterday on one of the panels about how difficult it is to sort of think about truth only as one particular thing. And, you know, and I think there are journalists and nonfiction writers here who are doing incredibly important work. But my hope is that a book of poems can access a kind of emotional truth that is just as important, if different in tenor, than that kind of work. So I'm happy to be here. And
now, so I've just been talking to writers who wrote, you know, very documented, David Grann and Lauren Markham. I'm curious, so this is a book where you're trying to convey a truth about this institution?
Yeah. So the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded was a real place. And in the early and mid-1900s, it was one of the major hubs of the American eugenics movement. And what that means is that from about 1920 to about 1955, thousands and thousands of people who either had or were assumed to have physical and intellectual neurological disabilities were forcibly committed and forcibly sterilized there. Not only without their consent, but often without their knowledge, they were told that they were being given appendectomies and instead were sterilized. The book involved a lot of research into that place and that period of time in American history, and it is in the voices of imagined patients and staff in the 1930s at the height of the sterilization movement.
So how did you research this?
So I did a variety of things. The first and most important kind of research I did, in some ways, I think, was that I actually went and spent time on the grounds of this facility, which is still a government-run residential facility for people with very serious disabilities in Virginia. But it also it's a strange place because, like a lot of things in that part of Virginia, it was built on an enormous amount of land. And so when the buildings that were the original colony fell into disrepair, instead of either rehabbing them so that they were up to code or knocking them down so that they could build new buildings, they just moved out of them and built contemporary facilities right next to them on all the available land. And so the place itself is this strange combination of a functioning facility and a ghost town of everything that it was and everything that happened there. And so I went and spent a lot of time just walking around the grounds of the colony, kind of tapping on windows and testing doors of these old abandoned buildings and spending time in the colony's cemetery. And that was really formative, just to getting a sense of the place and these spaces where people would have lived their lives. I also spent some time with the limited records that, from the colony that are available at the Library of Virginia, and a lot of time with a huge digital repository called the Image Archive on the American Eugenics Movement, which is a digital repository put together by several legal scholars. That is just a kind of massive resource on American eugenics. And that involves everything from
hospital forms to sterilization orders to journalism from the time period advocating for eugenics to propaganda postcards distributed by eugenicists of people suffering from various quote-unquote defects that were distributed to kind of advance the agenda of eugenics. And that material, I think, really gave me access into the language and the ideas of the time.
And it's sometimes hard for us to realize now how popular eugenics was and the circles that it was popular in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was an agenda and a way of thinking about the world and about medicine that had had huge support. Just in Virginia, you know, more than 8,000 people were sterilized, and this was going on in most of the states in the nation.
Did you set out to write this book, like think I'm going to do a book about this, or did it start with a poem and then it grew, or kind of how did it come about?
So I grew up near the grounds of this colony, and I knew about it in childhood and throughout my adolescence and thought about it a little bit the way you do something that's a kind of significant feature of your home. But it wasn't until I went to college that I came home for a summer and with a friend decided that we were going to drive around the colony land. We were kind of exploring my hometown, and I'd never been on the grounds. And so I thought, okay, let's just go and see what's here. And kind of from the time that I saw it and had an experience of this place, I felt really haunted by it, and I knew that I wanted to write something. I wanted to do something about the colony and about its history. And it took me several more years after that to kind of find my way into the space where I had the time and the kind of energy to undertake a project. But I had a sense, I don't know that I knew right off the bat that it was going to be a book, but I knew that it was going to be a project that was bigger than a single poem. And pretty soon after I started writing, I had the sense that there was enough material here for a whole collection.
How do you think of the audience for this book?
I mean, so my hope is that, you know, that this book might matter to people who really love poetry, and also maybe people who don't consider themselves regular readers of poetry. There is there's not exactly a story to the book, but there is a kind of narrative arc. There are voices that you get to know, and there is kind of narrative material that you can be attached to, and so I hope that you know, anybody who finds themselves interested in history, in the fabric of the past, and in stories that might not often get told, might find something to love in the book, whether they consider themselves a reader of poems or not.
In this vein of kind of historical documentary poetry, I don't know quite what to call it. Do you have examples that you were looking to of people who had done things like this?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of writers who have, in a variety of ways, kind of married history and poetry. There's a writer named Avan Jordan who wrote a beautiful book called Magnolia about the girl and later the woman who was the first ever African-American finalist in the National Spelling Bee and got eliminated in the final round in what was pretty clearly an act of racism. And he wrote a beautiful book about that experience, and then also about the life that she went on to live. And that book was a huge example for me. But there are writers like Gabrielle Cavalcaresi, Natasha Trethewey, who are doing really wonderful work, again, just kind of marrying a deep engagement with history and with the American past, with poetry and with poetic work.
When someone writes what, let me call it a standard nonfiction work, a prose book with lots of research and footnotes and lots of back pages with citations and so on, they access a certain kind of connection with the reader. Obviously, with poetry, it's a little different. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, so I think that a poet writing a book like this and a journalist or a nonfiction writer have some of the same responsibilities and then some different responsibilities. You know, I felt like I had a responsibility to do as much research as I could, to feel like I was well-versed in sort of all the material that I could get my hands on about this place, and to be kind of as steeped in the language and the facts of the time as I possibly could be. And I think that, you know, is a responsibility that is shared when you undertake something that has a kind of of historical backbone, regardless of the genre that you're doing it in. But because, you know, this is not a work of nonfiction, it is not a work of journalism, and it's not a work of research, and it doesn't profess to be, I have the ability to make some kind of imaginative and empathetic leaps. This is a real place. The book is based on real history, but all of the figures and perspectives here are imagined. And so I can really make some emotional, emotional leaps into thinking about, okay, what would it have been like to be a person here in this space? And my hope is that because I'm not constrained by fact, because I'm not, I'm not constrained by kind of verifiable fact that you can find a ledger or a report that backs it up. My hope is that the reader can have a more emotional and empathetic experience of this history, because I really try to put the reader inside the heads of people who might have been there, and that is something that I couldn't do as a journalist because there isn't enough material from the perspectives of the people who were colony inmates, colony patients, and that's a great loss. And I don't imagine that these poems could ever stand in for that experience. But my hope is that in their imagination of this time and this place, they essentially just put a floodlight on the great violence of having silenced and sterilized so many people, and refused to care about their internal lives and denying them a stake in the future of the world.
I'm talking with Molly McCulley Brown about her book, The Virginia State Home for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded.
How is it when you read this live in front of people?
You know, I've come to really, really like reading this book aloud and performing it for audiences. I think there is something really powerful, I think, about hearing a poem read aloud, particularly when that poem, tries to evoke a very specific or particular time and place and perspective. And so, I don't imagine that I can stand in for the actual people who live these experiences, but I do really like literally giving voice to these perspectives and to this imagination. It's a real pleasure to read this book.
Are there certain poems that get more of a response?
Yeah, I would say that there are a couple of poems in the book that people do seem to have really latched onto. Especially the book is divided into the rooms of the colony. There aren't very many rooms in which these patients would have made their lives, and I was really struck by that small number. And so each section of the book is named after one of these rooms, and there's a section in the middle of the book which is called In the Chapel, and it's set in the small chapel on colony grounds. And those poems have been poems that readers have really especially responded to, I think.
Is there a section of that you could read for us?
Sure. So this poem is called Psalm, and it comes from that section that I was talking about, in the chapel section. Once it was clear I would not die in early childhood, you wheeled me out along the coach road to the chapel to be baptized. Even half-wits might well have a soul to save. The concession science makes to faith. Whatever sins are visited upon my body, best to do all you can to cleanse them before they ease into the air like plague. After all, you would not want my life. Your children's children would not want my life. Stale sickness, some stranger stealing herself to touch you if she must, and then recoiling. The meek will inherit the earth, but you worry the mute and monstrous will pollute it long before that happens. So you strip me down, hold my head under the water in the basin, count to three, and pray in every language that you know. Dear God, bless this girl. Take her up and let her be the end of it. Put some distance between our bodies and hers. Take her out of our hands. Father, whatever force or fate has made me like this. Son, what will protect your daughters from a future like mine? Holy Ghost, you cannot hear what I am saying in the cathedral of my own head.
You have written a bit about the role of religion in your own life, and you came in you wrote that when you were younger, you were kind of an apathetic unbeliever, I guess would maybe be a way to put it.
Yeah.
But then you eventually joined the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I did. I did eventually convert to Catholicism, and that has been a really meaningful and powerful experience for me, even when I, you know, disagree with some of the politics of the church or some of the ways that things get put into practice. I had an identical twin who died when we were infants, and I think that my grief at her loss and also my sense of her continuing presence in some way in my own life, my sense that, something in her outlasted her very early death and remains connected to me and remains present for me in the world, that has made a belief in some sort of life beyond the one that we're living and some sort of spiritual existence really central to my life, because I feel the truth of that in a really experiential way every day.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about religious expression and poetic expression.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, they feel very linked, very twinned to me. Poetry, you know, long before I understood myself as having a kind of theological imagination or a real interest in religion, organized religion, I think poetry was the earliest language that I had for mystery, for things which felt beyond the life that I was living and felt unexplainable and felt tied to something larger and greater and grander than any single person or any physical world. And for me, you know, poetry still is very much about mystery and about accessing something larger than myself. And I think religion is also very much about that for me. And so the two things feel very linked. They feel in some ways like different means of expressing the same draw toward the mysterious and the divine.
What do you feel about poetry's place in American culture?
Oh, Lord, that's a giant question. my sense is that poetry has never been more vital or more necessary. I think that we live in a time where saying, I believe that taking care with what I say and how I say it matters is a strangely revolutionary act, a kind of unbelievably revolutionary act. And I believe we live in a time that needs beauty, needs a commitment to mystery, needs a commitment to metaphor, to imagining the strange things outside of our own lives and to imagining experiences that don't look like ours in whatever way. And I think poetry is a really vital way to do that. You know, it's been really interesting to me and really heartbreaking and also really powerful to note that in times of great tragedy, that is often when I see poems go viral on the internet. You know, something terrible will happen in the world and all of a sudden I'll see a poem get retweeted thousands and thousands and thousands of times and all of a sudden people are sharing that material. And I think there's something in the compression of it, in the imagination of it, and again, in the carefulness of it that people really respond to. And I think there's so much extraordinary poetry being written right now by so many people in so many places in America. So yeah, I think this is a really fun moment to be a poet in America in the middle of so much talent and so many lights. And I think it's a vital moment for poetry.
That was author Molly McCauley Brown speaking with our very own Bill Thomas, who's sitting right next to me. Molly McCauley Brown wrote the book, The Virginia State Home for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, and, of course, she's a poet, so it's a little
Yes, different. It's a book of poetry based on real things that happened. And I will say, you heard one poem in there. Her poems read very well. They're terse. They're not florid, and they are straight and to the point and well-structured, and she's winning a lot of awards in the poetry world.
Thanks, Bill. Decoded 8 book is next.
I just hear silence as rhythm. You know, when it's not there, anything could happen.
Performer and artist Laurie Anderson, next time on Studio 360.
That's coming up in the next hour, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Decoded 8 book for March 27th. North Dakota remembers World War I.
Throughout the first year after America entered the war in 1917, the War Department maintained a strict censorship on the news from France. To keep the public informed, there were brief war news presentations from the Committee on Public Information by the Four Minute Men. These were volunteers authorized to speak at movie theaters and public meetings on timely topics related to the war. Often speaking between the film reel changes at theaters, their speeches were restricted to 4 minutes, thus the name. Using local community leaders who were provided with general topic guidelines, it was a successful approach in promoting public support for the war. But it was mostly through the Associated Press that the public learned the general war news. In the fall and winter of 1917-1918, due to the nature of trench warfare, successful campaigns were often measured in yards, not miles. However, German losses in men and equipment were slowly bleeding the German army's strength, and North Dakotans, like most Americans, hoped for an early end to the war. In mid-March, the German command mounted a spring offensive in an all-out effort to gain as much territory as possible before the American expeditionary forces could become an effective part of the war. The news from the front in late March of 1918 was dismal, as the French and British forces, which included some American units, appeared to be in retreat. In the evening of Saturday, March 23rd, the Ward County Independent issued an extra edition which stated that General Haig and the British lines had stemmed the German advance. A large crowd of several hundred enthusiastic citizens gathered in the streets of Minot to celebrate. Speeches were given and the band played patriotic tunes. However, just a few hours later, the Minot Daily News, in its edition, denied the story based on new information. An angry crowd dissatisfied with this development gathered in front of the Daily News office. During the night, the front entrance to the building was painted yellow, and the words Kaiser and Slacker were painted on the doors and windows. The newspaper responded by posting a $100 reward for the names of the individuals who vandalized the building. They also posted a reward for the identity of the individual who submitted a story to the Fargo Forum that charged them with disloyalty. But they offered no apology for reporting their version of the news. It was what it was, good or bad. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Wednesday on Main Street, Galen Lee of Duluth won the 2016 Tiny Desk Concert Competition, and she'll perform Wednesday evening in Fargo, and she'll stop by our studio before that to talk about becoming famous. And WishFast, an event in support of Make-A-Wish North Dakota, started out as a student project. It now includes 4 cities across the state. It's coming up in May, and we'll talk about it with organizer Nick Schulich. I hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.